A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to The View, a live talk show brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. We're dipping into the archives to add some of our favorite video-only episodes to our podcast. To explore all of the shows, or to subscribe using your favorite podcasting app, go to questformeaning.org/VUU.
So, our guest today is Nate Walker, who is... Nate, what is your job now? Tell me. You do have a job, don't you?
I do. It's good to have a job. Yes. I work at the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute. And so the museum is the First Amendment Museum in Washington, D.C., and the Religious Freedom Center is sort of the educational arm of that as it relates to the religion clauses of the First Amendment, free exercise of religion and no establishment of religion. And so it is a great honor to work there.
Mm. I personally really like that museum. We hit that every time we go to D.C.
Well, so Nate Walker, tell us about what you're doing at the museum before we get to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Well, my role is to help train civic leaders about best practices in the First Amendment, and specifically how to engage in issues of religion and public life with, can you imagine, with civility and respect. So it's a great honor to work with Charles Haynes, the director of the center, and the entire museum team. It's a dream job. I think I might be in the happiest time of my career. So I was hired first as a consultant to build a strategic plan for them, and that was great. And now I'm, in essence, hired to implement the strategic plan, and now I'm regretting how ambitious I was in the plan. But no, it's a great opportunity, and I love it.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you do what you just said you do? How do people come to D.C. for the training, or how does that work?
Yeah, we do several kinds of things. One is public events. So, for instance, last month we hosted Madeleine Albright and people from the State Department to discuss issues of religion and the future of diplomacy. Last week we hosted discussions with members of parliament from around the world and leading scholars in this field to talk about best practices and good practices for religion and human rights. And so we were meeting with members of Congress. We were at the White House talking with Melissa Rogers. And
so
it was just...
Do you mean the staff, or who is there a cadre of people who are coming to these sessions, or?
Yeah, in this context, we had 20 people in a closed dialogue session from around the world to discuss these matters, and this was because of a grant through the British Council. We had another dialogue session in London in February on these topics. So these kind of closed and public kind of dialogue sessions is one way that we do our work. The next way is something that's emerging, and that's why I was brought on, which is we offer courses. And so we're working with Star King and with Meadville and other seminaries to create courses for religious leaders on how to prepare them to be First Amendment competent as they engage in issues of religion and public life. So it's exciting to be able to do educational ministry because that was my original call to ministry. So it's nice to be doing that work now.
Tell me what First Amendment competency looks and feels like.
Sure. Well, so the free exercise of religion is one part of the First Amendment, and then the non-establishment of religion is the other. And I think a simple way to put it is that throughout history, civilizations, and certainly the U.S., has promoted uniformity in religion over diversity. And I think in looking at the history of religious freedom in the United States, we've come to now, as a culture, we've come to really emphasize diversity over uniformity. And so these religious freedom restoration acts, for instance, when they were initially passed in 1990 at the federal level, it was an incredible moment of synergy and bipartisan collegiality, because there was a commitment to protect, in that case, Native Americans from having the rule of law infringe upon their religious practices.
And yeah, I was in that group back in the 90s in D.C. I was the UU representative in that group, and it really was the most tense and broad coalition I ever was part of. I mean, there were people there who wanted it for such different reasons. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, people like the ACLU were in the room, and people for the American Way and the UUs, and then very fundamentalist groups were in the room. And so the only thing that held us together, this must have been 96, though, not 90, right? Were there two iterations? Or
yeah, so 1990 was the case on Employment Division versus Smith, about the peyote case for Native Americans. Yeah, and then 96 was the passage of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
And so the only way we could get away, get to stand to be in the room together, was that you were not allowed any carve-outs. Everybody wanted to put exceptions that made their selves feel better. And I remember at the time, Irva Shivad, who then ran the National Gay Lesbian Task Force, getting into a screaming fight with Rabbi David Saperstein, who's now doing and has always done religious freedom work.
Yeah, he's an ambassador now,
An ambassador, about how this would be used against GLBT people, and that she just did not think it was the right thing to do without that carve-out. And, of course, there couldn't be any carve-out. So, yeah, it was, I mean, I remember this tension then, but there was basically an agreement that we all needed to stand for the principle of religious freedom, which I still hold. I still do hold that absolute thing. But can you talk about how these state ones are different from the federal one?
After 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Congress did not have the authority to apply that law to states. And so as a result, 19 states have since introduced their own state RFRAs, Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, and most of them mirror the language of the federal legislation. And during those early years of its enactment, it wasn't seen as controversial. In fact, there was a lot of support on all sides. But you know, going back to your question, Tom, like, what are these principles? Like, if diversity over uniformity is one of them, then another one is using sort of rule of law approaches to move beyond the zero-sum game, where my win is your loss or vice versa. And I think right now we are in that stalemate that's very much associated to what you were just talking about, Meg, which is rights, R-I-T-E-S, versus rights, R-I-G-H-T-S. And so I think the reason for that dualism is because two things have changed. First, with the Hobby Lobby ruling, which was a narrow vote where, in a 5-4 decision, corporations were given free exercise rights in order to get an exemption from a general law created through the Obamacare, right, Affordable Care Act, that would require corporations to provide contraception insurance that covered contraception for their employees. Yeah, so that's a very interesting case, and I think in the field of religious liberty, there's a very sincere divide on that case, from people like me who really are deeply concerned that that has made corporations a de facto congregation, whereby the CEOs are sort of the high priests of a new kind of organization, and I'm very deeply concerned about the power that that gives corporations, especially closely held corporations, which make up 80% of the U.S. corporations. And so I'm very deeply concerned about that ruling. I think it's it creates a lot of room for invidious discrimination. Invidious being a legal term for systematic discrimination against certain classes of citizens. And so, but then there are other people in the field, like my boss and colleague Charles Haynes, who saw Hobby Lobby as a win-win, as a potential way to balance those competing interests, and specifically that. His view and that of Doug Laycock, who argued for Hobby Lobby in that case, feel that if you give the exemption, then you allow that, you don't infringe upon that person's right of conscience. And then the people who are seeking those contraception services, because they have multiple other means by which to achieve that goal, then their needs are met too, and that's a reasonable balance. So that's their view on that, and then there are of course others on the more right of the topic who are very clear that any theological justification is above any kind of rule of law approach, right? That God's law is above civil law, and so they take sort of that approach.
So you work in an environment where you all just can disagree about that and be civil with each other about it.
Yeah, well, it's mostly because of Charles's character. He's incredibly kind, skillful, attentive, and self-differentiated. And so that's a great honor. And our work is not to be an advocacy group. Our group is to be an educational group and one that brings people together. So in our Committee on Religious Liberty, which meets 3 times a year, we have 90 different people representing groups from a broad coalition to have these kinds of conversations. So we're that kind of mediator so that Church of Scientology representatives and ACLU and, you know, the Catholic bishops and the secular coalition can all be in one room speaking with the Southern Baptists and so on the moral issues of our time. And so I have to learn to tone down my sort of long-standing training to be a liberal fundamentalist, right? I have to sort of put a check on my own biases as I enter these conversations. So this is a great honor to kind of move. I feel like I'm developing morally and intellectually as a result.
Nate, I have a question. Is there a point to the conversations in terms of when you have all these people in a room? Is there an agreement people are getting to? Is there, what is the framework, and are there conclusions that are asked of the group?
So Charles has spent 20 some years creating consensus documents, and so you can see them at religiousfreedom.org under the partnership section, and you'll see hundreds of organizations that would otherwise be in gridlock and not able to speak to one another on all kinds of issues, from Bible and public schools to issues of bullying and LGBT rights and religious rights and religious speech versus hate speech and so on. And it is remarkable the kind of legacy that he has built in doing just that, in achieving consensus documents. And so in that way, the museum, the Religious Freedom Center, has a great reputation of doing that kind of convening work so that people can practice that really deep listening and achieve understanding, and aware that understanding does not necessarily imply agreement. But where there is agreement, they can then craft these consensus documents to move it forward.
I'm just wondering what your take is on the rhetoric around because what we see certainly isn't that kind of civility and equanimity that you're naming, that you're striving for there around. And I admit, I don't feel a bit of equanimity around some of the homophobia coming up with in the name of religion. So how do you see the national landscape, and how do you see what helps? I mean, I just don't see agreement is ever going to come, just as it didn't with that original RFRA group. We just fundamentally disagreed about what religion was for.
Right. I'm very hopeful, actually. I actually think that these conflicts, these public divisions, and their really divisive rhetoric is an incredible opportunity to move things forward. So let me explain what I mean by that. In the latter half of the 20th century, the moral majority, you know, or sort of the 80s and 90s, had a really strong hold on religion and politics, where religion was actively and continually being used as a political wedge issue. So a very famous example is abortion. So before Roe versus Wade, the Southern Baptist Convention voted to affirm a woman's right to choose. Soon after the Roe versus Wade decision, they also made another affirmative right to choose statement as a convention. It wasn't until Falwell and others started to use religion as a wedge issue to try to get more conservative votes that it started to shift. And basically, that's when evangelicals, who traditionally said, oh, abortion, that's a Catholic issue, adopted that issue for political ends. I saw the same thing happen with the contraception mandate. So there were 22 states that had the exact mandate that was replicated in the Affordable Care Act. And in it, it said that corporations had to provide for women insurance that covered contraception. In 22 states, there was never a lawsuit. There wasn't a huge outcry. It wasn't until Obama took office that in the rhetoric about anti-Obama care, did that topic become all of a sudden a religious issue, when before it wasn't. So my sense now is that when we see the governor of Indiana and other governors sort of or legislators come forward with these RFRA laws, they're doing so as a way to galvanize the right to support their political agenda, trying to use religion as a political wedge issue. But what we're really finding is that it's no longer working, and that's where I'm hopeful, because more and more faithful religious people are coming out and saying, you don't represent my view. I am an evangelical, and I do not believe in same-sex marriage, but I do believe in civil rights. And you're getting these really interesting nuances and divisions. We're in a time of radical reformation within religions. And as a result, the political rhetoric that was previously used by the moral majority is proving to have dissolved and lost its potency. And so that's where I'm most hopeful, is that religious people are saying, no, my religion's not a political wedge issue. Now, at the same time,
Nate, do you think also, though? I mean, is it that maybe the face of religion is sort of losing power? Do you think that might be part of it as well? I mean, so I just want to throw that into the discussion as well.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, we are on the brink of reaching a demographic where the first time in U.S. history, Protestants do not have a majority of the population. Right, it's bordering at that 50% right now, and with an increase of Catholics as a result of immigration, and also an increase in Muslims and of course the nuns, right, the non-affiliated group, you're getting to see a dilution in the power, and therefore diversity is the norm, and governing pluralism is very hard to do. And I think a lot of these political groups are trying to figure out, well, religion used to be such like a win for conservatives, and now they're seeing it's constantly being used against them. And so, yeah, it's less potent as before.
I'm taken by this, this historical narrative that you lay out about this kind of rise of the religious right as a political force. over the last 40 years, and the fact that you tie its end with the end of Protestant hegemony in the United States as they lose their majority status. So what else do you think has caused that force to diminish, and do you think that's going to continue to be the case?
I think another primary force is the rise of the rights movement within the LGBT community. Mm. So if you take a look at the Utah Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it mentions protections for people based on gender identity 41 times. Mm. This is unbelievable. This is unprecedented to have a majority Mormon legislative community look back on their own acts with their contributions to Proposition 8, right, in California as it related to their stance against same-sex marriage. And they're looking back and they're saying, actually, as a community, we're not against rights. We have very sincere, long-standing views about marriage and the sanctity of that, and that doesn't change. But we are able to self-differentiate between our religious views and that of civil rights. And so to have a majority Mormon community affirm in 41 times in a bill gender identity rights, which is one of the most complicated ones of them all, is unprecedented. And so that kind of reformation is occurring within various religions, from Presbyterians and Methodists and Episcopals. I mean, it's utterly fascinating, the kind of reform that's taking place. And as a result, there is a political window to have LGBT people, for the first time in history, become an equal protected class under the 14th Amendment. And that is really what's at stake, I think, in this upcoming marriage case, which is going to swing on Kennedy's vote. And so I hear some conservative pundits make very clear that this is not the court ruling, this is Kennedy's opinion. And I find that kind of argument disingenuous, because you could argue the same of Hobby Lobby, right? Well, that was just Kennedy's opinion because he was a swing vote on it. The fact is, there is that gridlock in the Supreme Court, and that's a mirror to our society's gridlock on these questions. But that gridlock is softening as the more and more people know members of their family and come to love and respect them and see them as humans and not as the other. That kind of moral imagination is really developing in our society, and I'm so grateful to be in this field at this point in history. There's a fundamental shift in how people understand religious freedom. And one of the best articulations I've heard is by Judge Carol Jackson, who said that liberty is a shield, it's not a sword. So liberty is a shield to protect the most vulnerable, to protect religious minorities, to protect religious expression or persecution or coercion, right? Or even to protect those from, de facto apostasy kinds of situations where they cannot change their religion or have no religion at all, right? Or to have atheistic views and so on. So in that way, liberty is becoming more like a shield. But when people try to use it as a sword, I'm going to use my beliefs in order to do something that will cause you harm. Maybe to lose your job, to not provide you kind of marriage legal protections, to deny you services from purchasing things, these kinds of segregation kind of base kind of practices. I think more and more and more our collective conscience is saying, no. You cannot use your religious views as a sword to harm another. You can use it as a shield to protect your practices and the practices of others, but it can't be a sword.
But, the right is a genius at acting like they need the shield. I mean, that kind of, and I think they genuinely believe it, like that Christianity is under attack and, you know, their values. I mean, well, I think it's genuine on the part, at least of the followers, if not of the leaders.
I was wondering if part of this is also, I mean, I do think people have fun beliefs about those in the LGBT community, but I wonder if some of it's a red herring politically, because people are getting wise about Medicare not getting expanded, the Affordable Care Act, so the more and more people from either side or from the right are saying, hey, we're not buying what you're selling, all of a sudden it's like family values, LGBT, and I'm wondering if that's also part of the why this narrative keeps coming up in different ways. Because when people are becoming politically hurt, I mean, financially hurt and unable to feed their families and asking the right questions, that this comes up.
Yeah, those are really good points. I should clarify that in many parts of the world, Christians are under attack. Like Kenya, 147 Christians just slaughtered in a university. Right. So in many parts of the world, Christians are under severe attack. And so those who follow that narrative very closely and who see that the U.S. government is not taking a really clear and bold stance on making those protections for Christians in other parts of the world, they then equate those acts to what's happening domestically of this change of definition of family, of marriage, these fundamental things that have been for thousands of years the norm, right? And that is frightening.
At least in our minds.
Yeah, yeah. And so what's actually happening is more religious groups are on their own accord expanding the definition of family. Religious groups on many fronts are expanding their definition of rights, civil rights, and making distinctions. One of the best ways I've heard this distinction made is by Christine Carlson in a chapter of our book, Whose God Rules. And she starts it by saying, when I was born, I was given a birth certificate by the state. And then my parents took me to get baptized, and I got a baptismal certificate. And when I die, the state will give a death certificate to my loved ones, and my church will have a memorial service, and there will be a program that will be a memory of that. And so she sees that as the kind of self-differentiated type of religion that knows what our religious rights, R-I-T-E-S, and how they're distinct from that of civil or human rights and the role of the state in providing equal protection for all people to have access to those rights.
So you slid this in, but since you mentioned it, I just want to lift up your book.
Sure. It's called Whose God Rules, and Ed Greenlee and I co-edited it. He was the president of the First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia, where I was senior minister, and we had an amazing experience pulling together people from all different types of worldviews to discuss issues of religion and public life in the U.S. Tony Blair.
Who did the foreword?
Oh yeah, Tony Blair wrote the foreword, and I love it because he says that he did this speech in the UK where he said, God bless the British people. And there was this like political riot over it. And his aide said, this is not America, you know. And so I sort of use that as a segue to say, why is it that political actors in the US cannot close a speech without saying, God bless America? Because So I start to sort of make distinctions between UK and America, and what is it about the nature of our political system, which I think is a theo-legal political system where theology is used to make law. And so we have interesting commentators in the book, from Martha Nussbaum to Alan Dershowitz to Bill Schultz to all kinds of interesting players, like on the right, we have Robbie George, who makes a case for stem cell research and how it shouldn't be publicly funded and so on. So, yeah, that was a great opportunity to work with those thinkers.
Patrice, you've been trying to get in here for a while.
Just kind of listening. But I just wanted to throw out an opportunity for Nate to make a linkage between the work that you're doing and the body of Unitarian Universalists. How would you say that a congregation how would you say a congregation could engage with this work?
Thank you. That's a wise question. One, I think that we have the opportunity to really refine our message to make clear that we are pro-religion and pro-rights. And I think that might come to be a difficult sell for many people in our congregation who have an allergy to religion and to an allergy to authority. But I think that is the fundamental challenge for us internally, for Unitarian Universalist communities, to not breed the liberal fundamentalism, but to breed understanding, and to really have that self-differentiated view that we are seeking to preserve the inherent rights and dignity of every human being. And so in that way, that also means having the capacity to have the moral empathy for those with whom we disagree. Because when we enter the public sphere and we are in a screaming match, in a deadlock sort of fight against those who we have seen cause us and our families great harm, then we are perpetuating the dualism and the fight, and that I don't think is going to be helpful.
I wonder if we have a deeper issue along with what you're saying, mm-hmm. but might we need to look to our own house first?
Yeah, same one.
A lot of our congregations, inside our congregations, all are welcome in our principles, but all are not necessarily welcome in the way in which we are together.
Are you saying, meaning implying that like Republicans can't be members? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I mean politics, but also even we have differences between, polyandrous families or Christian UUs or, whatever the minority is in a particular congregation, theologically, can sometimes feel that, they may feel somewhat stifled a bit or not feel like they're really fully seen or appreciated. I think that's sometimes that's the case in some congregations. They have that rub between the theists and non-theists, whatever that means. But
yeah, no, I think that's really beautifully put. If we go back to the principles we've been talking about, like diversity over uniformity, or beyond the zero-sum game, or liberty as a shield and not a sword, I mean, these kinds of things I think would be deeply helpful as we navigate each of those markers that you discussed. And our own seven principles give us the guide to do that. And I think, in a way, one of the great strengths of Unitarian Universalism is its pluralism. It's what makes us unique. It's what makes it a challenge. But ultimately, we're trying to, as we use Mark Hicks' phrase, like build the world we dream of, right? Like, we have to start in our own home to do that work.
One of the, the deeper issue is purity, that people... There's an impulse toward purity, that people want to have an environment which repels things that are, quote, impure, and that a lot of the motivation around kind of the use of an argument about rights as a sword against other people is a identification between religion and purity. I want to, it's my right to live in an environment which is pure and free of, you know, transgender people, homosexuality, blah, 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 blah. You know, I want to be able to live in a community. It's my right to live in a community that repels those things. The assertion that people have a right to discriminate is a right to purity as a religious value.
That's thoughtful. And another way to put it is that is liberty a vote or a veto? I remember when I was in Nevada in 1999, and I went through the adoption process, and I went through all these interviews. I had portfolios, and they had recommendations, and they did financial background checks and all kinds of stuff. And in the very end of the process, they said, "Do you plan to get married?" And I said, "Well, yeah, eventually." And they're like, "What would your wedding look like?" I said, "Wow, I don't know. I think women might be conditioned very early on to kind of imagine and role play their wedding, and I don't know what my wedding would look like. I'd have to ask my husband." And that's when the woman pulled out her necklace, clutched her cross, and said, "I'm sorry, you don't meet our definition of family." Now, in that scene, you have purity of the family, right? You have this belief that I have the power to veto you because you don't meet our definition. So what happened after that? I left Nevada to start a new life. I literally called a company called Drive Away, and I said, "I'll deliver a car wherever you want." And I ended up in Bethesda, Maryland. And I've been on the East Coast ever since. So it's in that context that when I was in New York and I was doing my internship in White Plains, I met a New York senator, and he had said to me, "If you want to get married, why don't you move to Massachusetts?" And there's another sort of purity motive. Well, like, not in our boundaries.
Right.
Like, liberty for me is a veto to, why don't you go? And I felt like I kept being banished from one state to another, or one country to another. But I think now things have changed so dramatically that more and more people are seeing that liberty is a vote. You can parade in the public square, you can seek to persuade people, you can use your religious rhetoric in order to try to make your position, but it is not a veto to eliminate the rights of others. And so I think that's another major shift that's happening.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.